Yeah.
Good morning. We'll open the meeting. It's 10 a.m. on
February 1st.
It's 10 a.m. Wednesday, February 1st, 2012, here in the North Dakota Public Service Commission hearing room, 12th floor of the state capitol in Bismarck. For anyone who's listening in, and for the record, this is Tony Clark, Commission Chairman, and I'm joined today by my fellow commissioners.
Good morning, Kevin Kramer. Welcome.
Good morning, Brian Kulk. Welcome as well.
With that, there are items on the consent
agenda. I'd move passage of the consent agenda items.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Moving to items in my portfolio, I move the commission assess a filing fee of $10,000 and issue a notice of opportunity for hearing in the application of Northern States Power Company for a certificate of public convenience and necessity to construct and operate a proposed 230 kV Peace Garden switching station in 300 feet of 230 kV electric transmission line to interconnect with the proposed Border Winds Energy Project to the existing 230 kV Rugby to Glenboro transmission line in Rolette County, North Dakota, case number PU-12-39.
Second.
The commission's quite familiar with the Sequoia project. This is in relation to the Sequoia Border Winds Energy Project. Basically, the situation here is this. XL is the owner of, or the operator of that particular transmission line that is to which Sequoia is seeking interconnection, has an obligation to construct facilities upon reasonable request to do so. And this particular project would require this type of switching station as well as 300 feet of transmission line to interconnect the project. It's not something that XL has to build out of its own pocket, of course. There are requirements for the Border Winds to reimburse XL for the cost of interconnection to the line. The Border Winds project requires a rather aggressive schedule for completion. According to the application that's filed, they desire to get it up and running by December 31st of 2012, which then in turn requires a rather aggressive schedule for the switching station that XL would propose to build, and they have entered a generation interconnection agreement to do so. One of the things that may be worth noting is that XL is submitting this, they indicate, because from a regulatory permitting timeline, they would need to have this CPCN to get it done. So they're starting the process. They do indicate, though, that there is some uncertainty as to whether or not Sequoia will be proceeding with the project in the given time frame. There are the generation interconnection agreement required certain payments and thresholds, and some of those may not yet have been met. But regardless of that uncertainty, whether the project will go forward or not, XL, from a regulatory standpoint, would need to get a CPCN. So this is the reason for this application.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And TC2, I move the commission adopt the order changing business hours for Archer Daniels Midland Company, Minneapolis, Minnesota, to permanently operate its Underwood, North Dakota warehouse on an as-needed by appointment only basis. Case number GE-12-49.
Second.
As a result of a request, an ADM will post a notice advising customers of the business schedule and phone numbers for contacting the company.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
That ends the items in my portfolio. Commissioner Kramer.
Thank you. KC1. I move the commission submit the mining and reclamation rule changes proposed in case number RC-11-236 to the Office of Surface Mining as State Program Amendment 39.
Second.
This is an order change that was requested by BNI Coal. We did have, after going through all of the proper notice requirements, we did have actually, I don't even remember if it was an informal or a formal, but we did have a hearing on these rule changes in after the hearing after they were sent to the Attorney General for his sign-off. We now are required to send them to the Office of Surface Mining for their concurrence as well or their approval through the state program amendment process. The rule changes relate to letters of credit that are pledged as collateral for a collateral bond, and they involve the financial information and notices that banks issuing a letter of credit must provide to the commission. Basically, what it does is it reconciles our laws with and our regulations with the banking regulations. Currently, we require a CPA certified or approved audit, if you will, of the of any letter of credit or of the institution providing the letter. What this rule basically says is that if the regulators at the bank have already approved it, which requires basically the same rigor, maybe even a little more rigor, simply certifying that should be adequate. And we agreed. Attorney General felt the rule was done appropriately, and now it's just a matter of submitting it to OSM for their approval.
All in favor?
Aye.
Casey 2. I move the commission acknowledge the letter of intent, shorten the one-year waiting period between filing a letter of intent and a citing application to 2 weeks, and assess a filing fee of $68,000 due upon filing an application in case number PU-1240, Plains Pipeline's proposed crude oil pipeline in Montreal County, North Dakota.
Second.
This is actually the first of two actions regarding Plains. Later on, we'll be actually issuing an order or voting on an order. But Plains, which we've become somewhat familiar with, they're a Texas limited partnership. Actually, they're a master limited partnership. Been around for about 20 years or so, a very big midstream company. They filed a letter of intent for a certificate of corridor compatibility and a route permit. This is about a 17-mile line that's being proposed, 10.75-inch outside diameter pipe. It would extend from being Plains Pipeline's existing Robinson Lake pipeline, which is east of Stanley, and then it would run to the proposed Ross Terminal located northwest of Ross. It's designed to deliver 47,000 barrels of oil per day, roughly just under 2,000, of course, barrels per hour. That equates to about 220 trucks per day of Bakken crude from their Robinson Lake station to the Ross Terminal. Their hope is to get under construction by the second quarter of 2012 and be complete by the fourth quarter of 2012. The total cost is projected to be about $13.6 million.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
KC3. I move the commission acknowledge the letter of intent, shorten the one-year waiting period between filing a letter of intent and a citing application to 15 days, and assess a filing fee of $6,712 due upon filing an application in case number PU-12-42, Magellan Midstream Partners Proposed Petroleum Pipeline in Cass County, North Dakota.
Second.
I think anybody that's driven into Fargo is familiar with the Magellan. Magellan Midstream provides, of course, access to Fargo and Grand Forks terminals refined product that comes mainly, I think, out of the Twin Cities. This is a pretty small project. It'll modify the existing design capacity. It will not modify any existing capacity or anything, but it basically moves the line 2,300 feet. There's some road construction or improvements going to be done on Main Avenue in Fargo, and they need to, near as I can tell, move the line basically from the north side of Maine to the south side of Maine for about 2,300 feet. So we just today basically acknowledging the letter of intent, and everything seems to be in order. Let's see, there was a small price tag, I think, attached to this. Just a little $1,342,500 project to move pipe 2,300 feet. Anyway.
They've got an aggressive time frame, too.
They do,
They want to begin construction by March of 2012.
They do, and we'll have to have some discussion about that once the application comes in. Call before you do. One thing you don't have to worry about, I think, with these guys and with the Department of Transportation right on the top of them, they'll probably take care of all of that.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. KC4. I move the commission acknowledge the letter of intent, shorten the one-year waiting period between filing a letter of intent and a citing application to 2 months, and assess a filing fee of $100,000 due upon filing an application in case number PU-12-43, Enbridge Pipeline's proposed crude oil pipeline in McKenzie and Williams Counties, North Dakota.
Second.
Those are familiar words. Enbridge proposed pipeline in McKenzie and Williams County. We received this letter of intent for a 42-mile crude oil pipeline system that they are referring to as the Sanish Pipeline. Of the 42 miles, nearly all of it is a 12-inch line. There's a short 6-mile stint that would be 10-inch pipeline, all of it, of course, in McKenzie and Williams counties. It would connect new Bakken receipt volumes gathered from the existing Saddle, Butte, and Arrow pipeline stations. You might remember that we cited those a little while back. These are short lines and short stations on the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation or near it, and it would connect them to Enbridge's new Johnson Corner Pump Station and Terminal, which is at, it's a corner of a couple of pretty important highways, as I recall. But anyway, we'll get to that. It's from Johnson Corner, it would be 12-inch pipe that would go north for about 36 miles, and it would cross Lake Sakakawea, and they're proposing horizontal directional drill of about 2.5 miles under Lake Sakakawea. Of course, that will require a permit from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The new Johnson Corner Station will include two new 30,000-barrel tanks to accommodate obviously 60,000 barrels per day of incremental pipeline capacity to move the Bakken production to the Beaver Lodge Station, which we've become very familiar with. And from Beaver Lodge, shippers, of course, will have entry into Enbridge System's mainline system for further transportation to Clearbrook, Minnesota. Of course, 60,000 barrels per day represents roughly 300 trucks. So 60,000 barrels per day, incremental pipeline capacity, 300 trucks if you were taking it over the highways. They hope to be completed by the fourth quarter of 2013 at a cost of $135.6 million.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
KC5. Getting back to Plains. I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order in the request of Plains Pipeline LP for a waiver of procedures and time schedules, a corridor certificate, and a route permit for the construction of 32.1 miles, 12.75 inch outside diameter crude oil pipeline in Williams County, North Dakota, case number PU-10-630. This is a project that consists of, in total, about 79 miles of pipeline from the Plains Pipeline Trenton Station near Trenton, North Dakota, to an interconnection point with the existing Wascana Pipeline, which is about 2.5 miles north of the town of Outlook in Sheridan County, Montana. The North Dakota portion of the project is about 32.1 miles at a cost of roughly $25 million. It utilizes 12.75 inch outside diameter steel pipe and has an initial capacity of about 48,000 barrels per day, 240 trucks, with a maximum capacity of up to 75,000 barrels per day ultimately. Again, this is just more of Plains' very aggressive entrance into the Bakken midstream market and another way to get oil to market. This particular line is somewhat interesting because, as a note, it goes into Montana, and then it joins up with this Wascana line that goes straight north up near Regina, Canada, where there's access to a couple of major lines, including an Enbridge line that runs toward and to Clearbrook, sort of paralleling the North Dakota Canadian border before dipping down into Minnesota. And then there's also the Keystone. It crosses the original Keystone pipeline. I don't know that there's anticipation of an on-ramp, but it is right in the same vicinity. And there are some other shorter, I think, midstream lines up in that area. And again, like a lot of them, this is also represents a change in market because those south to north lines used to be north to south lines. So kind of interesting how more American crude going into Canada versus the other way around. Everything seems to be in order.
The only thing I'd quickly add to this project is that this project and a lot of the ones we've had recently, we've had a lot of discussions, I've had a lot of questions about making sure the companies have their emergency response plans in order because we're getting so many pipelines being built so quickly. And that's one of the things that we've started to add to the order is that Plains will prepare an emergency response plan and make it available to local authorities and first responders. The companies have always done a really good job of this, but kind of stepping it up a little bit, making sure that they have the plans out there, that the local first responders are aware of it. So as the construction finishes and they start putting product through it, we're prepared to do whatever has to be done.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. That ends items in my portfolio.
Pipeline Day at the public service.
Yeah.
Maybe Pipeline Week. Boy, although we had a power line hearing, so it couldn't be that.
Pretty big power line.
Power lines make you appreciate pipelines.
Yes, they do. That's a very good point.
Anything else for the good of the order? We don't have a lot of meetings coming up over the next few weeks. We've got a Mid-Continent hearing coming up at the end of next week, but NARUC is next week, so I know. I'll be gone, as well as just a few staff members. Any questions?
All right. And since we talked about the Enbridge pipeline, under Sakakawea, it's going to go under Sakakawea, correct?
It will. They anticipate a horizontal directional drill underneath the lake, which, of course, requires a pull. It's 2.4 miles that they expect to pull underneath after, of course, drilling from one side well off of course, the shore and taking an angle down underneath the lake and then across and then pull it back up the other side. Then, of course, they weld it prior to pulling it through and kind of just keep welding as they pull the whole 2.4 miles up the other side. So, but that does require a permit from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. We haven't had a lot of lines. We've had some. But I'm trying to think if we've had one that's actually been built that we've cited that was pulled under Sakakawea yet.
We had the hearing, but it never finished.
Right. They haven't finished that one yet. The closest thing would be when they finally buried on the bottom of Lake Sakakawea the gas plants.
Dakota Gas.
Yeah. CO2 line. But that they didn't horizontal directionally drill. They actually trenched with barges.
So what are going to be the challenges to siting this pipeline, given the fact that the Corps is involved and probably BLM, from what I understand?
Well, you know, it's interesting you ask that, Dave, because in all honesty, the jurisdiction between the Public Service Commission and the federal government are two different jurisdictions. So we literally will site the line just like we'd site any line, and then it's really up to the other agencies to do their part, because our permit would, of course, be conditioned on approval by the other jurisdictions, the other authorities. So it's really quite separate, except that they can't build it without either one of us, I guess.
And it's something we're very familiar with. It's not the first time we've had pipelines that deal with these sorts of issues. As we talked about, there are other pipelines that run across Lake Sakakawea or have been through the siting process. And there are lots of streams and rivers that have similar type federal nexus. I mean, the Trans-Canada Keystone Pipeline, the original one, anytime it crossed a river that was had core jurisdiction, which was a number of them. So it's a familiar process to all of us on the commission.
I would also envision, I talked about emergency response plans, but I suspect I'll ask a lot of questions about their emergency response plan for this, considering where it's going.
Well, I'm going to say, with the Missouri having, 98% of the surface water in North Dakota is in the Missouri system, and a lot of that's in Lake Sakakawea. Mm-hmm. That's why I asked if there's going to be some challenges or some interesting things that you might have to go through when you go through the siting process, or when the company goes through the siting process.
Well, one of the things I would say that's comforting, and this goes back to sort of our history of siting pipelines, and including the Keystone, is the company's commitment to horizontal directional drilling brings its own set of comfort, because horizontal directional drilling allows the pipe to get even further underneath the bed of the lake and the river. It also requires stronger pipe, because it's not just because you want thicker pipe to avoid a problem, but it takes, you know, much more strain when you're pulling a pipe 2.4 miles. It requires strong welds, thicker pipe. It's really many, many good safeguards that are there for a horizontal directional drilled line. The other thing about a horizontal directional drill line, I don't know yet whether we'll get into this, of course, at the hearing or once we have an application, but oftentimes it might be double. There might be a double layer or something like that, or a pipe inside a pipe. I don't know what the company's proposing, but there's no question that when you go under an important body of water, or any water for that matter, I mean, water is the one liquid more precious than oil to any state, and ours included. There's great care and caution that is taken, and appropriately so.
So you're very confident that they will do it right. at the
time? Well, that's what. Well, we don't know. I'm confident if they want the pipeline built badly enough, they'll do it right. Because if they don't, then we can't approve it, of course. But that's why we have the process that we have.
And in similar cases that we've had, these are the type of questions we ask, especially after, remember, this last spring with the Yellowstone incident with the Exxon pipeline. And in just a recent case, that incident in Montana caused us at the siting hearing to ask questions about, okay, what's different about this line? How can you assure us that what happened there won't happen here? So, you know, we keep track of what goes on in the rest of the country as best we can. That one happened to be fairly close, and it causes you to ask questions about future lines to ensure that you're mitigating against those types of risks.
One of the things, though, in general nature, Dave, is the concern that the companies have all these plans in the shelf, but do we have the actual capabilities to respond to those plans in the shelves? Are the trucks and the booms and all those things in place? And that gets outside our jurisdiction, but it's something I think as an industry that I know they're looking at, and I think that as a state we need to make sure we're looking at that as well. Because it's one thing to have something in a book somewhere, another thing to actually have it exercised. That's where I think it was the eastern part of the state, they did an exercise last summer of actually doing a mock spill and cleaning it up out in the Valley City area. They actually exercised that capability for the Keystone Line in the eastern part. So those are good kind of things to see.
One thing about Sakakawea being a reservoir, you don't have that same flow and erosion that you have in a fast-moving river, for example, except, I suppose, right in the river itself or in the river channel itself. But, again, the horizontal directional drill really provides them the opportunity to pull much deeper under the bed, which should help prevent that type of erosion that would expose the pipe. But, again, this is why we have this process. It's why the application is as rigorous as it is and why there's a hearing.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that came out of that previous case was discussion about the river flow, for example, in the Yellowstone versus Sakakawea. And I think that, if I remember correctly, they had discussed that even the existing DGC pipe that was constructed, they were able to, the river flow, even in a rather extraordinary year like we had this year, was such that you could still see the contouring from the spoil piles and things like that underneath. They hadn't been eroded away. So there are different circumstances, but those are all the kinds of things that we can take into consideration.
Well, since you brought up the hearings on the CAPEX 2020, what do you take away from the hearings? What kind of impressions did you get? There were some landowners who were mm-hmm. upset. We know about that. But what happens next?
I was pleased with the tenor of the testimony that we received. It was very good testimony. I mean, you basically have a situation where you have landowners who are kind of, the takeaway that I got is they have a sense they're kind of getting a double whammy here. These are folks who happen to be just on the outside of the diversion already. So they're on the wet side of the diversion. And but for the proposed diversion, the original placement of this line was somewhat further north, so they would not have had been dealing with the transmission line. What we heard from the company this past week was that once the diversion basically became known, the strong sentiment that they received from a number of parties, from lots of different people across the area, was all of the future development is going to go on inside that diversion on the dry side. We'd prefer that you not take up tracts of land with a large transmission line. That pushed the transmission line to the wet side further south. So two competing interests. The folks on the outside of the diversion are saying, look, the diversion's not a sure thing, and if it never gets built, then we have to deal with this transmission line that we wouldn't have otherwise had. People on the that take a different point of view, or maybe on the inside of the diversion, say, please don't take up valuable property on the dry side of the potential diversion with a transmission corridor. These are tough decisions, and I've always thought that transmission lines are perhaps the most difficult thing that the Public Service Commission deals with. They're above ground. They're unsightly. No one really likes to have a transmission line in their backyard, and yet they're important. They're needed to keep the electric reliability of the system going. And so you take all these factors into consideration. That's what we're going to be doing over the next several weeks as we get the late-filed exhibits, as we try to weigh the information that we got at the hearing. But I would just say that from a standpoint of the tenor of the conversation that we received, it was all very, very good input and much appreciated.
One thing I took away from it is there is no perfect place to put a transmission line, and that nobody's land is more valuable to anybody more than it is to the person who owns it. And those issues are obviously more complicated the more people there are in the area. And when you're crossing a river and building a line to a population center, going through basically a lot of population center, it's very difficult to find that space that doesn't impose it on someone. And this one's a tough one because there's not a lot of spread out space when you get in the Fargo area. There are a lot of people. And yet, the demeanor of the witnesses at every level was respectful, serious for sure, and concerning. But frankly, there's a fair bit of frustration. There's just a fair bit of frustration with what's happening. It's ironic, though, it was, you know, some of those communities in that area in Cass County, they're smaller communities that feel like they're being beat up on by the big community, and then on the other hand, they're kind of getting beat up on by landowners. And so it's kind of, I learned that there are a lot of great advantages to being a small community near a large community, and then there are some disadvantages.
The thing that I thought was interesting was there was a lot of discussion about, you know, if the diversion is going to be built and how that may affect, you know, the transmission placement. So that's one of the questions that I remember talking about. But that'll be interesting in the work session to talk about as well. But even the point about once Minnesota picked their route, it maybe became more complicated for the North Dakota route because they've got to hook up somewhere. So that really, I think, those sharing of jurisdictions, it makes this even more challenging.
And then just one more thing, Commissioner Kolk, when you talked about having these emergency response plans, is that going to be required of all pipelines from now on? Or
It's always been required that they file it, but I think what we've tried to do is elevate the discussion so the emergency responders get a look at it ahead of time and actually are involved in the development process of it.
Okay, very good. Thank you. We will reconvene at 10:35 after order signing for the administrative portion of our agenda. Thank you.